So we're looking at text 40 of chapter 3, which is called Karma Yoga. And there's a series of verses was talking about problem of lust. Sanskrit, the word is kama, for lust. Which it doesn't just mean sexual desire, kama, although sexual desire is the main expression of kama, sexual enjoyment. But it's just the general desire to enjoy the senses altogether, sensual pleasure. This is called kama. But Sigmund Freud, who studied these things carefully, described sex as the prototype of all pleasure. So, it also means that particular. So here we're looking at part of Krishna's analysis of this kama on text 40. So we have the verse here, so we can chant the Sanskrit together. Translation. The senses, the mind, and the intelligence are the sitting places of this lust. Through them, lust covers the real knowledge of the living entity and bewilders him. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The enemy has captured different strategic positions in the body of the conditioned soul. And therefore, Lord Krishna is giving hints of those places so that one who wants to conquer the enemy may know where he can be found. Mind is the center of all the activities of the senses, and thus, when we hear about sense objects, the mind generally becomes a reservoir of all ideas of sense gratification. And as a result, the mind and the senses become the repositories of lust. Next, the intelligence department becomes the capital of such lustful propensities. Intelligence is the immediate next-door neighbor of the spirit soul. Lusty intelligence influences the spirit soul to acquire the false ego and identify itself with matter and thus with the mind and senses. The spirit soul becomes addicted to enjoying the material senses and mistakes this as true happiness. This false identification of the spirit soul is very nicely explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam 10.84.13. Yasyatma buddhihi kunapetri datuke svadhi kalatradishu bhoma ijyadhi yatirta buddhi salilena karichich Janesha Bijneshu Saeva Go Karaha. A human being who identifies this body made of three elements with his self, who considers the byproducts of the body to be his kinsmen, who considers the land of birth worshipable, and who goes to places of pilgrimage simply to take a bath rather than to meet men of transcendental knowledge there, is to be considered like an ass or a cow. Ma Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Simati Bhakti Vedanta Swamaniti Namane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharine Nirvishesha Sunyavari Paschacha Deshatarane. Mangyanam timurandasya gananjana shalakaya chaksur militam jainam tasmai sri gurave namaha. So the previous verse, some of the same words are there. This describes how the dehinam, the embodied being, the soul, who has a material body, how his state is jnanam avritya, his knowledge is covered. So the previous verse, avrittam jnanam, begins with those same words. The wise living entities, he calls the living entity wise because by nature the soul is full of knowledge, satchidananda. So, what we call innate knowledge is covered. If you, the word education, edukari, means to take something that's already there and bring it out. It doesn't mean to put something in. What it means, actually, the root meaning of the word is to take, to uncover or to disclose what's already there. That's the root meaning of education. So, actually, the living entity is has jnana, or knowledge, intrinsically. What Krishna is telling us in the Bhagavad Gita, actually, we already know. And that's why if we hear Bhagavad Gita properly, we'll recognize what Krishna says is true. When you learn material knowledge, you know, when you learn that something like you know, that sulfuric acid is made of two hydrogen atoms and a sulfur atom and two oxygen atoms, you don't recognize that as true. But when we understand that we're eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss, actually, we're just being reminded. So whatever Krishna tells us is reminding us of what we already know. That's why this book is quite different from many other books of knowledge. It's real knowledge. Otherwise, material knowledge, it's useful. Like learning chemistry, it's just like learning the SEPTA bus schedule. It gets you from one end of the city to another. So the same thing about chemistry or physics or anything else. It's to navigate yourself a little bit around the material world. But it's very superficial. But real knowledge is to get you out of the material world. So anyway, that's why the living entity is called wise. But it's covered. His pure consciousness becomes covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust. So he's called Nitya Vairina, his eternal enemy, which is never satisfied and which burns like fire. A couple other things about lust. It is never satisfied. You do not see, when a person is very disturbed by lust, wants to go out is like an itch that has to be scratched, or like a fire that needs to be put out. So when one goes to do that, it's not as though that having satisfied my desire in some way, I am now at peace. It's never satisfied. I may get a brief moment of peace, but then it comes back even more intense. So no one has actually become peaceful by satisfying their desires. So satisfying these desires is like trying to extinguish a fire by pouring gasoline on it. It goes down briefly and then boom, flares up bigger. So that's why it says it is never satisfied. It doesn't. It just grows. Whatever it feeds on, it just makes it stronger and stronger and stronger. So he says it's his enemy. So Prabhupada says, the enemy has captured different strategic places in the body of the conditioned soul. And therefore, Lord Krishna is giving hints of those places so that one who wants to conquer the enemy may know where he can be found. So that's already a rare person who wants to conquer the enemy. Most of us, Mr. Lust is our best friend. We already sold out to him. He's the eternal pitchman. He's got his arm around our shoulder and saying, try this, try that, take this, take that. And we've actually objectified him and put him on television in the form of commercials, so he comes off and incites our desire more and more and more. So, but he's our enemy. And people don't know that. But those who actually want to belong to, I guess we have to say, is a rare elite. Those people who actually say, this lust is my enemy, and I want to conquer him. That's who this Bhagavad Gita is meant for. Everybody else is more or less doomed. Because it's described here what lust does. It covers the real knowledge of the living entity and bewilders him. So because that knowledge is covered and he is bewildered, the living entity suffers. It says, and it is the process by which he comes to suffer and how lust bewilders him is described very analytically in this purport. There are, in the West, religious groups who know that lust is the enemy. And some of these little groups, preachers get up and yell and scream about it all the time. And people feel we've got to do something about it, but it still goes on. But they cannot give you actually any very precise idea of why he's your enemy. All you're told is that these activities are sins and they'll cause you to go to hell. The truth is, you're already in hell and they'll cause you to stay. And it may get worse. And so what that hell is precisely described. Hell is identifying yourself with the material body. The knowledge of the living entity, when it's uncovered, the first stage that knowledge or that bewilderment, that illusion is going away, is the living entity realizes, I am not this body. And hell is acquiring what's described here in the purport as a false ego. The word ego is simply the Latin word for I. It simply means I. So when I think of I, what do I say? Who do I think when I say the word I? Well, if I've been bewildered, that's described here in this verse from Bhagavatam. What a person who's bewildered thinks. Sa eva gokaraha, that person has the brains of a cow or an ass. Even though he's a human being, Bhagavatam says gokara is actually no better than an animal. So his bewilderment is he thinks himself this kunape, this bag. This is a kind of bag. Huh? The skin is on the outside, so it's a bag or a sack, a leaky sack. But a sack nonetheless, a bag, made of three elements. According to the Vedic idea, the material body is constituted, analyzed as composed of kapha, pitta, and vata. Ayurvedic doctors analyze the processes in the body in terms of prominence of kapha, which is usually translated as mucus, pitta, which is bile, and vata, which is air. Anyway, that's another kind of a science, what we call an alternative healing modality. Although actually it's very old and it's given by the Vedas and it works. And modern medicine's the alternative healing modality, really, but that's another issue. Anyway, it's a bag, and it's made of whatever, blood and mucus and bile, that's the sack. So you think this sack of stuff, this is me. I am this body. And then whatever is in relationship to the body, my sexual partner, my significant others, whatever, that's mine. These are my people. Just on the basis of we all have that characteristic, you know, nose, or we all, whatever it may be, that gives us our, you know, close-knit tribal identity. We all got that red hair, whatever, you know, we certain genes in common. That's mine. And Boma Ijadi, and thinks the land of his birth is worshipable. Yes, you're a patriot. When you hear the Star Spangled Banner, your eyes fill with tears. You turn to your friend and say, gee whiz, isn't this a great country? And people do. You know, people born in America, they think, oh, America's the greatest country. We're so fortunate. We're better than everybody else. Look at those poor Cubans, you know, setting off a little rafts just to come to America. They must think Cuba's hell. Well, go talk to them. They'll tell you Cuba's the greatest country. Yeah, right now we got a problem, but otherwise Cuba's great and America stinks. But still we want to go there. They think Cuba, you know, and when they get to America in Miami, what do they make? Right, little Cuba. Because it's still Egypt, it's worshipable. So these are the idiots, huh? Cows and asses. They think that this rotting bag of various elements is me, that these people who are related to me, they're mine, and this country of my birth is worshipable. And then here, Yatirtha Buddhi Salidena Karichit. And this is, of course, the Vedic system, that usually the sacred places of pilgrimage, like on the bank of the Ganges, that if you take a bath there, your sinful reactions will go away. But also in those places of pilgrimage, there's many saintly persons. And if you go and you associate with those saintly persons, you actually can gain spiritual knowledge. That's what they're really for. But these people who are cows and asses, they don't do that. They just go take their bath and say, "See, I've done the thing," and they leave. So they go practically like tourists. So this means they go, this means in general people who have some religious process, but they don't learn anything, they just go through the motions and go home. So even if they have something that separates us from the animals, that is to say religious principles, they just go through the motions. Those religious principles are there to give us spiritual knowledge and to elevate us out of this condition. But they've got them, but they're such idiots, they just go through the motions and go back to being cows and asses. This is what it means to be bewildered. Such people, even though they go through the motions, they don't receive any transcendental knowledge. And they remain in the material world. So this is what it is to be covered, to identify oneself with the material body. This is me. This is my family. This is my community. This is my country. This is my religion. All these things are wonderful. Why? Well, just because they're mine. You know? So, this is a gokara, no better than a cow or an ass. The trouble is with all those wonderful things is they're causing birth and death in the material world. And what causes this stupidity, this foolishness, this bewilderment, is lust. The living entity is a spirit soul. And as a spirit soul, we are eternal, without any birth and without any death. We are by nature happy and joyful and effervescent all the time. We don't need anything to get us high. Actually, people in the material world are trying to get high because they want to get out of their bodily condition. They're just sitting around in a material body and just taking what it gives you, everyone's miserable. So they're taking various kinds of intoxications, which doesn't bring relief. Some temporary thing, and then again you're addicted and you have to get more, and you become more entangled in the material world. Well, they're looking for their natural state, which is free from identification of the self with the material body, but these artificial means of liberation don't work. Instead, you become more attached, more bewildered, not less. Anyway, it's described that one should actually want to conquer this enemy. It is this lust, this desire to enjoy in the material world, which causes all our suffering. That's what's the trouble with it. It's not that we're going to simply sin and rant and rage and say this is a sin or this is bad or this is evil and not tell you why or what the cause, what the reason is. There's a very simple reason. So if we can see this reason, then we can, as reasonable people, do something about it. And what we have to do is we have to target this lust for destruction. Now, the other problem is doubt. Okay, I recognize that lust is my enemy, and that this lust is the cause of all my suffering. And this was said, by the way, very nicely by Lord Buddha when he says, you know, that the material existence is suffering, birth is suffering, death is suffering, old age is suffering, disease is suffering, not getting what you want is suffering. All these things are going on all the time. And the cause of the suffering is our desires. The same thing. Kama, lust. That's the cause. And so one has to become free from this lust. So you may say, well, that's an impossible project. And perhaps unhealthy also. Certainly the whole world is thinking that by satisfying my desires, I'll become happy. Otherwise, why do they keep doing it? They don't keep doing it and actually increasing what they need. I mean, you might notice the project of trying to become happy by satisfying your desires has increased those desires. And as soon as a person gets this, they immediately want that and that. And when they get that, then they want more and more and more. So what used to be called the necessities of life, a few things, the bare minimum necessities, now the bare minimum necessities are, well, yes, I just need the bare minimum necessities, and I have to work day and night to get them because the bare minimum necessities costs $150,000 a year. Bare minimum necessity is two cars. Used to be if I had a pair of shoes, that was fine. Now I need a pair of automobiles. So all these things. And actually the things that are really the bare minimum necessities, those are getting hard to get, just like clean water. We got to import it from, you know, far away in bottles. Clean air, you know, that's like a big problem. Just like some food, healthy food to eat. You want to eat healthy now, it really costs you a fortune, you know. What's cheap is the junk food, the healthy food, the simple stuff. Is what costs a fortune. So actually the paradox is the real necessities are becoming unattainable, and all the artificial necessities that we can that we are getting. Anyway, it describes here the strategic positions in the body. So they're mentioned here, Indriyani, Mano, Buddhi. Intelligence, well, starting at senses, mind, and intelligence. So the senses are first of all there. By senses it means the instruments by which we acquire knowledge, our sense of sight, our sense of hearing, our sense of taste, our sense of touch, and our sense of smell. But also the senses by which we act back on the world, the instruments by which we act back on the world. So in Vedic understanding, my hands are senses. Not only do they have skin by which I touch, but I also manipulate objects. So I act on the world with my hands, so I can manipulate things. And I have legs by which I can move myself around, genitals for reproduction and so on. These are the active senses. So what my body is really a kind of organized arrangement or array of instruments or senses for receiving information or impressions from the world and acting back on it. So it says that this mind and buddhi are called the subtle body. Our material body is there in two divisions, the gross division, which is the makes up all the senses and everything, this bag of senses and the support system for them. And then the subtle body, which is made of subtle matter, which is called manas, buddhi, and ahankara. What we call the mind, in the West is subtle matter and is not spirit. The soul is spirit, but mind and so on are temporary also. They're material. They're also not ourself. Ourself is the spirit soul. So the subtle body has these three divisions called manas, buddhi, and ahankara. So it says here, mind is the center of all the activities of the senses. Yeah, all the impressions from my senses are fed into my mind. And the ideas or the impressions, the memories are stored up there. So I have some particular, I bring my senses into contact with an object and I feel some pleasure. That association of that object with the feeling of pleasure is retained in the mind. So the mind is also sometimes called the 11th sense, because there are five knowledge. Which is the central sense, which coordinates all these other senses. So the mind is the center of all activities of the senses. And thus when we hear about sense objects, the mind generally becomes a reservoir of all ideas of sense gratification. The function of the mind is really to accept and reject in terms of sense gratification. So that I put something on my tongue and it's sweet, and the impulse of the mind tells me, go ahead, enjoy it. If I put something on my tongue and it's bitter, the impulse of the mind is to spit it out. So this is the way the mind works. It accepts and it rejects things simply on the basis of whether they feel good or don't feel good. And it stores up the ideas of everything that feels good. And it becomes the place where our habits reside, or our addictions. The attachment to going back and enjoying this. This felt good, let me do it again. And then other people tell me, I hear about other things, this is good, oh, let me do that, let me do this. So all this is stored up in the mind. So when the mind becomes, when this lust is there in the senses, basically this senses come in contact with the objects, they feel good, the mind stores these feelings up and directs us to repeat them over and over again. So it says the mind and the senses become the repositories of lust. So it starts with the senses, then it goes to the mind. Now there's this next sentence. Next, the intelligence department becomes the capital of such lustful propensities. Now what intelligence means, or buddhi, is that intelligence actually, it determines our focus of attention. And sometimes intelligence overrides the mind. Like, for example, I put something bitter in my mouth, on my tongue, the impulse of my mind is to spit it out. But if I have received instructions from a physician that this bitter stuff is medicine I have to take and it's good for me, then I'll stop my I'll stop from spitting it out. I'll block that impulse to spit it out and swallow it anyway. So this overriding the impulse of the mind, whenever that happens, that's the function of intelligence. So intelligence works in this way, to direct. We need intelligence to do anything, actually. I mean, you couldn't get through the walk across a room without some intelligence. Just like a little kid who has no intelligence, they have no attention span. And they go wherever their mind takes them, so they just wander around. So that it's very hard to do goal-directed activity. Because to do goal-directed activity, sometimes you have to ignore what is pleasant and endure what is unpleasant in order to get to where you want to go. If you just accept what is immediately pleasurable and reject what is immediately painful, then you can't do anything. So a large part of training children is developing their intelligence so they can, you know, get up in the morning and go to school, for example, a lot of which is unpleasant, but which you have to do anyway for some future good. So that just the mind by itself, people who have no intelligence, or like if you smoke marijuana, the first thing it does is destroys your intelligence. And so people who smoke marijuana when they're at least under the influence of the drug, and a lot of times when they're off of it, they can't do long-term goal-directed activity. Their senses get immediately attracted to this thing and to that thing and this thing and that thing, because the intelligence has become blotted out. Or so little children, the same way. If you want them to do something, you've got to walk them through it and gradually train them. Otherwise, you just get hung up. Just do what feels good immediately, and if you go away from feels bad immediately, and never keep any goal in mind. So any long-term goal-directed activity takes intelligence. So what happens when the mind becomes the repository of sense gratification is all our long-term goal-directed activity, the whole thrust of our mind, the whole bent of our attention is towards sense gratification. Even whatever long-term goal-directed activity, it's there for sense gratification. I'll enjoy more later if I have a little deprivation now. So this is called lusty intelligence. What I'm interested in, what attracts me, is sense gratification. And I can't think there's anything beyond that. So my whole attention, most everybody you see has lusty intelligence. And what the Bhagavad Gita is trying to do to us, get us to do, is to change our intelligence, to change the direction of our mind from sense gratification to self-realization. That's why what's taught in the Bhagavad Gita is sometimes called Buddhi Yoga. The yoga of buddhi, of intelligence. To change our whole mindset away from this idea of sense gratification. Right now we have all the habits of sense gratification. We think the highest aim of life is sense gratification. We think that happiness comes from sense gratification. This is all lusty intelligence. Lust has taken over the intelligence department. But when we redirect our attention towards self-realization and we become intelligent or goal-directed towards self-realization and not sense gratification, see, that's like a whole shift in consciousness. And that means we have to retrain our whole mind. A large part of Krishna consciousness is to destroy the habits of lust and instead replace them with the habits of spiritual realization. Our habit in Krishna consciousness is to get up at 3:30 in the morning. Our habit in sense gratification is to get up at about 11 a.m. In fact, to go to bed at about 3:30. We have different habits. So that's a difference of intelligence. It's hard for us to understand this idea of intelligence because mostly we don't have any. So the concept is hard for us to grasp. But we become intelligent in Krishna consciousness when we fix our goal-directed activity on satisfying Krishna. When our goal-directed activity is fixed on satisfying my old senses, then we're called a materialist, and our intelligence is polluted or contaminated. Lust has taken it over. That's what he's describing. We have contemplated the sense objects, we have dwelt on them, and now we have acquired a lusty intelligence. He says here, intelligence is the immediate next door neighbor of the spirit soul. So beyond this subtle body is the soul. The soul is already described as pure and wise. The soul is not this body. The soul is eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. But what happens is, it says here, lusty intelligence influences the spirit soul to acquire the false ego. The soul then becomes bewildered. And because of this impetus toward sense gratification, the soul then identifies itself with the material body. I am this body. Everything in relationship to the body is mine. That's what happens. As soon as we engage in the activities of lust or of sense gratification, we are forced to identify ourselves with the material body. It is not possible to engage in the activities of sense gratification and to have any realization whatsoever that I am not this body. We may say, oh, I'm a Hare Krishna, and our philosophy